Welcome to The Digital Patient, where we discuss the latest advancements in digital patient engagement and share stories from the front lines. I'm your host, Alan Sardana, and with me, as always, is Seamless MD CEO, Dr. Joshua Liu. Today, we're joined by our very special guest, Dr. Marcus Speaker. Dr. Speaker is a family physician and Associate Chief Medical Information Officer at the Carilion Clinic, where he has served for over two decades now. Dr. Speaker, Marcus, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
It's fantastic having you on the show. You've had such a rewarding career that has really borne witness to the evolutions of informatics and healthcare technology. Like I mentioned in the bio, you've been with the Carilion Clinic for over two decades. You've also played an instrumental role in Epic integrations and are focused on clinical decision support and expanding clinical functionality. To start the conversation, though, I wanted to go way back. What got you into computers and electrical engineering, and then why family medicine?
How much time do you have? We can go way, way back. Back when I was probably 10 or 11 and got my first Commodore 64. So old school, and did programming on the Commodore 64 and then moved to the 128 and then loved math and science. And so when I got to college at West Virginia University, engineering kind of made sense as the thing. Although I was young and naive and Top Gun had just come out. So I was thinking about doing aerospace engineering and then going to the Navy to fly planes as a pilot. Don't know what I was thinking there. But in that freshman year, they had a general engineering course that all the different flavors of engineering came down and kind of showed what they were doing. And again, the computer and electrical engineering, that group just resonated. The computer piece was not accredited. At that point in time, there was only one, or there were two accredited universities with computer engineering degrees, and that was the Naval Academy and Carnegie Mellon. So I did electrical as well, so that if the computer engineering program had not been accredited, I would at least have an accredited degree from a four-year accredited college degree. So that's the computer electrical engineering piece. And then as a senior, decided that I didn't really want to do electrical engineering for the rest of my life. It was too much like the Big Bang Theory. I was living that with all the Star Trek jokes and Star Wars jokes, and I got to do something different, and took a biomedical engineering course. It was one of the first ones offered, and we looked at MRIs and how you could tell the position of a thumb through this specialized MRI at the time, and I thought, wow, that's really awesome to be able to do that. But so then, the rest is kind of history, turning off toward medicine. Now, the family medicine component, it's really exciting because, the MRI piece was like, okay, maybe I want to do neurosurgery, which, again, is kind of crazy. But on my way to med school, I spent the summer volunteering in a free clinic in Morgantown, West Virginia, called Morgantown Healthright. And obviously, I had no medical background, but was working the front desk, was talking with people, and that primary care piece was just, it was an overwhelming experience. It was amazing to be able to help people that needed help in that free clinic, working alongside a number of the faculty from West Virginia University would come down there and staff the clinic, and so being able to work beside them was just an amazing experience. And so said, yes, I think I want to do family medicine. They got into med school, and obviously that was the right choice. So putting it all together, yes, it was kind of crazy.
Yeah, Marcus, I think, we talked to quite a number of, CMIOs and folks in the clinical informatics world, and it feels like folks who are in primary care or hospitalist medicine tend to be the most common types who end up being in the CMIO type role. I'm curious, do you think that's just coincidence, or is there a reason why folks like yourself in primary care end up going into clinical informatics and leading in those roles?
I think it probably is a combination of things. I think certainly a family physician that has been family medicine trained, you do obstetrics, you do pediatrics, you do urgent care. So you have the breadth of knowledge. You've done the surgical rotations, you've done the OB rotations, you've done the ED rotations, and so you kind of know all these different aspects of medicine. So it puts you in a very good situation to be able to communicate with most physicians. I also think, right, as we started through the digital technology age,
with the EMR implementations, there were fewer board certified ED docs, because I also think that an emergency medicine doc makes a really good CMIO, because they also have that breadth of knowledge. But the family medicine docs, primary care docs, and internists to some extent, they were getting to that point in their career. So they were hitting their mid to late career timeframe and were looking for something different. Some of those were really good with technology. And so those became some of those first CMIOs and pioneers. So I think, again, a combination, but I think as we're going forward, we're seeing more and more specialists, we're seeing more and more ED docs starting to shift into informatics and add that. But I think that's at least initially why we've seen so many from primary care.
Today's episode is brought to you by SeamlessMD, which enables health systems to digitize patient care journeys, leading to lower lengths of stay, readmissions, and costs. Josh, you used to be a doctor. Did you ever feel like patients showed up unprepared for surgery? Or maybe you felt like you were sending patients into a black hole after discharge?
All the time. You know, we give patients paper and verbal instructions, which are so easy to forget and really hard to follow. And we have no idea what happens to them outside the hospital. So what happens? Well, because we worry about them, we keep patients in hospital longer, but that drives up length of stay and lowers throughput. Plus, after they leave, patients get readmitted for infections and all kinds of problems that we could have just caught earlier if we monitored patients.
What if I told you there was a way to give every patient a virtual companion so you could automatically engage and monitor them through a surgery, a cancer journey, or a chronic care journey, and drop the length of stay, increase throughput, and lower readmissions?
Gosh, Alan, that would be amazing.
So that is exactly what SeamlessMD does. It allows health systems to engage patients on their own phone, tablet, or computer with automated reminders, education, and symptom monitoring. Basically a GPS through any healthcare journey.
That sounds fantastic, but does it actually work?
It does. Health systems have done over 40 studies and evaluations showing how they use the solution to reduce length of stay by 1 to 2 days, readmissions by up to 89%, and costs by over $1,000 per patient.
Huh, but how does that work with my EHR?
That's the best part. SeamlessMD is the only solution in this space with direct integration partnerships with Epic and MyChart, Oracle Cerner, and Meditech.
Huh. Well, you know, I am getting a colonoscopy soon, so I really need something like this. Where can my health system learn more?
Well, Josh, thanks for letting me know. Your health is very important, and endoscopy is just one out of the 50-plus out-of-the-box care plans available today on SeamlessMD. Go to www.seamless.md. That's www.seamless.md to learn more.
So, Marcus, I have to ask, you know, you've been with the Carilion Clinic for, like I said, over two decades. What's kept you there?
Oh, so when we first started this journey, it was Carilion Health System. And as I moved through, we became Carilion Clinic, moved from that health system to a clinic model, implemented Epic. And I have this belief that Carilion Clinic continues to grow, and being part of something bigger, helping drive that change to see what will Carilion Clinic be like in 10 years. It's been an amazing transformation here in Southwest Virginia in terms of bringing the practices in and working to standardize and reduce variation and take care of over 1 million people in Southwest Virginia. And so just being involved with that is really awesome. Maybe the other thing that drives some of that is my wife. She says she doesn't want to leave Roanoke, so
yes.
Kind of stuck here. Not many associate CMIO positions available in Roanoke outside of Carilion.
That's fair. I'm curious, when we look at other industries, let's say outside in the healthcare system providers, because let's talk about maybe like technology companies or other businesses, I think we've seen a shift in how long folks are staying with organizations. So, decades ago, it was so common that you would spend 20, 30 years, at the same organization. But I feel like now with like the new generation of young professionals, it's a lot more common that folks are staying, 2-3 years and trying something new. Do you feel like there's been that same generational shift in healthcare lately, or is healthcare different because there's so much still brick and mortar care that folks still tend to spend a long time with the same health system?
I think you still have, for providers, that when a provider starts, they tend to stay a little bit longer. Although some of our young providers, especially those that do shift work where they can kind of move in between systems, I think we are seeing some of that. as we moved through COVID in the IT sector, we found people shifting jobs very, very quickly. And so that was one of the challenges that we faced coming out of COVID, was retaining and bringing in new talent. And with the shifts that we've seen in working from home and the hybrid models, what's the term? People can change jobs, but not change seats. Yeah. So I can be working from home today with my home office set up and working for one company, and another company says they want to pay me 10% more. I can just shift and start working for that company and don't have to pick up, don't have to move. We've heard stories of people bouncing back and forth between two or three companies, coming back to the same company at higher rates. And so people and trying to negotiate those higher salaries. But yeah, I think shifting around is the new norm in some cases.
Well, you know, speaking of the frontline provider experience, I think one of the things that Alan and I really noticed about you was, even though you're a technology and informatics leader at Carilion, you really thought a lot about how do we bring the joy back to medicine, the joy back to healthcare, and investing in employee well-being. One of the things that, I guess the way that we met was, I saw you speak at Becker's in one of the panels, and what struck me was that there was a conversation on the panel about, you know, what's the best tech investment you made lately at your health system? And everyone else was talking about more, I think, I don't say obvious, but the more common answers, things they've implemented in software, their EHR and whatnot. But you said, hey, one of our best investments in tech was actually a Starbucks coffee machine, because you felt that anything that brings connectedness back between frontline clinicians is so important to tackling burnout. I thought that was such a really unique point of view coming from someone in a CMIO type role. What did you mean by this, and what have you learned from that?
I guess that's the family medicine. That's the family doc in me coming out. I'll kind of share the backstory on that. When I was a resident at the hospital here, we had medical records. So in the medical records room, there were all the paper charts. And so you would come down and you'd have to sign orders and complete records. And you didn't have access through the EHR. But on the side of the medical records office, there was the physician lounge. And there were some leather couches in that lounge. And we always called it the leather lounge. That's what the residents called it. And the docs would kind of congregate there, two or three, not mass quantities, while you were waiting for people to bring in your records or while you were waiting for something. And that's where the relationship started to develop or continued to develop. When we put in Epic, paper charts went away. There were no more paper charts. And so we didn't need a physician lounge. And the physician lounge went away. And fortunately, our senior administration realized that the docs need that space to get together and have those conversations. And so they kind of built out another space. And in that space, they put this automatic coffee machine. And you had to badge in, right? So if you didn't have a physician badge, you couldn't get to the coffee machine. But the docs would come down and they would badge in and they would get their cup of coffee and they would see each other and they would have conversations. And so, again, I think that is so critical to taking care of patients and taking care of ourselves, developing those relationships, that connectedness we share in the journey of patient care and our struggles. There are few people that understand the struggles of physicians other than other physicians. And so being able to talk through those things with colleagues is really important. And so, again, I think bringing those docs together and giving them a place to talk and meet is critical to bring joy in.
Yeah, I think one of the fascinating things about technology sometimes is it's made it so much easier for us to collaborate separately from separate locations and not be in the same room, that sometimes it actually disconnects us and it makes it hard for us to build camaraderie. So I think it's really neat that, I guess, maybe sometimes we swing too far in the other direction with technology and even some of the simple things like you mentioned to bring us back, brings that kind of like healthy balance between tech to do things quickly but remotely versus kind of being together in person. That's wonderful.
Yeah. I would also just share that one of the things that we've seen here more recently as we started to come out of COVID is that those younger workers that have kind of always been hybrid, they don't seem to be making those connections.
Yeah.
So your workers that made the connections before hybrid started, they're keeping those. And they're doing things outside of work and maintaining a building. For those that are just joining, there still seems to be this isolation, and less in the physician realm, because the physician and the provider work is still really hands-on, but in the IT sector, there's a lot of isolation. And so trying to break down that isolation is key.
Yeah, actually, in line with that, Marcus, I was wondering, do you have any other suggestions for CMIOs or IT leaders to kind of, it was some sort of initiative to bring back that joy amongst, especially those younger colleagues that maybe didn't grow up with that culture already ingrained?
Forced fun. Nah, but maybe not too far off the mark. One of the things that occurred here at Carilion on Friday, there was a group, and I had no hand in this, but our IT side, strictly IT side, they put together a stocking stuffer project, stuffed over 300 stockings.
Wow.
That will be delivered throughout the health system. But what was really great was that we had a couple people that are fully remote that showed up. We had one person drive up from Georgia to spend 2 days up here, well, 2 nights, stuffing stockings. And so it brought the group together to do that work. And so meaningful. It was meaningful work, giving back to the organization, or it could have been any organization, but it brought that team together outside of best practice advisories, preference lists and things like that, and really made a difference. So, you know, it doesn't have to be stocking stuffing, but how can you once or twice a year get people together to share in something that provides meaning and, you know, and potentially is driven by what they're doing? So it's their interests.
Yeah, I think one of the neat things about being in, you know, in the provider setting is that unlike other organizations, like let's say a technology company or other businesses where you could just do everything remotely if you wanted to, because in-person care is still such a huge part of healthcare delivery, you won't totally ever lose that part of it. And so I get that maybe some of the younger folks don't have to do it as much, but they still have to do it. And I think that's actually maybe one of the nice things about healthcare, where you won't lose that in-person collaboration. You have to do it. And so more than any other type of industry, you keep seeing the benefits of it. That's really neat. You know, Marcus, one of the things that you've emphasized in the past is the importance of, you know, sharing and learning best practices from other organizations. And, you know, how would you advise, I guess, other healthcare digital or IT leaders, especially those who don't come from healthcare where this kind of sharing is so common, but what would you advise folks to maybe more effectively share and implement best practices when it comes to digital and clinical informatics?
Sure. Yeah, and that's outside of healthcare, that does get difficult because you start worrying about intellectual property and pieces like that. But I think having organizations focus on where are we going to innovate? We can't innovate everything. So there are a couple spots where an organization says, this is where we're going to focus. This is where we're going to be different. This is where we want to be on the cutting edge or the bleeding edge. And then the rest of it is learn and steal and figure out who's doing those things the best and just do them so that you're the blocking and tackling, to use a football analogy, is kind of taken care of. And you can still be innovative, but don't try to innovate everywhere. And so making those connections, networking, figuring out who's doing what, and not so much steal, but just use those best practices.
One of the things that reminds me of is in our industry or in the business world, I think one of the common phrases is, you know, you don't need to innovate on everything, like innovate on your product, maybe on your business model, but like don't try to innovate on the tested and true methods of how to run an effective team meeting or how to organize your company in terms of the structure and the people and the roles. like innovate on the stuff that matters that only you can innovate on, like the product. I think that's a really great point, Dr. Speaker. Sometimes, Marcus, sorry, I ruined the casualness of it, but I think it's such a good point that sometimes I think, you know, we try to be too creative. We try to find innovation in everything, but you're right. Like focus on like the 10% that matters the most, innovate on, and the rest, like blocking, tackling, just rip and deploy, do the other R&D.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. And that thought is not original. First time I heard that, it was Judy Faulkner at Epic, who basically said, you know, yeah, take the best and just implement it. Just do it, because you don't have enough IT people working for you to do everything.
Yeah, I love that. So Marcus, obviously AI is all the rage today. You know, with the availability and popularity of these new LLM APIs, I've heard you say in the past that there now exists a tremendous amount of vaporware, just like back, you know, in the early 2000s. And when EHRs first came up, there was a lot of vaporware hitting the market at that point, and same with today. So I'm curious, what advice would you give to other professionals in the industry looking to adopt AI technologies, really ensuring that they're focused on value as opposed to just the AI solution of it all?
Wait a little while. This is one of those places where being on the cutting edge or the bleeding edge may not be the best thing. It may not make the best business strategy, because there are a lot of people that are coming to market with virtual scribes using AI. Everybody's getting in on the large language model piece and generative AI. And when you start to engage the presentations are great. But when you dig down underneath, you start finding things that may look good on the surface, but when you look at some of the product critically, very quickly you realize that your compliance office, your legal office would risk management, they would start losing their minds, because from a generative standpoint, it's some of the notes and pieces that are happening are not really what you talked about. We had one vendor that, as we were going through a demo, where we mentioned GERD, and in the assessment and plan, it put this whole outline of what to do for GERD, and we hadn't talked about any of that. We hadn't started talking about a proton pump inhibitor or anything. And from the standpoint of making it easier for providers, yes, that potentially looks good. But if we didn't talk about it, it goes in the note and says that we talked about it, that's a huge liability. And so those are the types of things that we have to watch for. And as we're looking at prompt generation for these large language models, following hallucinations very carefully, to some extent, the medical advice, I think that as we're doing some work right now with our providers in InBasket, being very careful with what advice we're giving to patients and what advice the language models are generating. But just wait a little while. Now, if you have people that are super embedded and are learning about large language models and AI and generative AI, and maybe take that leap, have a back out plan, right? So that if you put something in place, that sometimes when we put IT in place, it's really hard to get rid of, making sure that there is a plan if that company doesn't do so well. But just very careful these days, very careful.
Can I ask you, it sounds like sometimes some companies maybe overstate how ready a solution might be for the healthcare environment. I'm curious, in your experience, like, why do you think that happens? Is it that maybe they know it's not ready, but they're under pressure from like investors to get something out there to grow? Is it more that maybe they lack clinical DNA sometimes in the team, so they don't fully understand that the bar for safety and readiness is much higher? I'm kind of curious, like, why do you think it is that sometimes things get in front of you that really aren't quite ready just yet?
Yeah, I think it's probably, multiple reasons. Perhaps it's one of these situations where the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, and there may be some plausible deniability. So the marketing team is different than the development team. And so the marketing team talks to the development team, and the development team says, oh, we'll do all these things. And nobody really stops to ask, well, when will it do all of those things? And it'll do it when it's implemented. Well, okay. And you're kind of going down that road. And so then the marketing team does the dog and pony show with potential customers. They don't understand that it really has not been completed. They have the slide deck that shows all the functionality, but maybe that's not really the functionality. It's mock-ups, it's videos, and so you're kind of clicking through to make it look like it's there. But I do think that's a place that causes issue. I don't necessarily think I would like to actually tell myself that it's not this malevolent thing where people are intentionally lying about their product. Potentially there's some miscommunication. Or the other piece is that when we get it to market, it do that. And so it hasn't been completely built out yet. We kind of have the framework and all these other things are coming. And so you buy into it, then you'll have those other things as well. And sometimes you figure out that you really can't do all of those things that you promised.
You know, I think a good recent example of what you just mentioned, Marcus, is that new Gemini video, that Gemini AI video from Google, where it looked really good. I didn't really look that much into it. I didn't even watch the video, but I just saw the news. But apparently, Google admitted that it was a heavily edited video.
All right. So, yeah.
But the stock price went up a lot initially when that video came up.
I bet.
But even at Google scale, this is like it is happening for whatever reason, you know?
It's all about the highlight reel, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. When, you know, we saw some of that back a couple of years ago with the commercial or the video where somebody called in and the system was scheduling a hair appointment for someone. And so it was picking up information and able to schedule. Yet sometimes a little more heavily edited than others, but
wasn't that also the Google Voice AI? I think it was Google.
Yeah, but it was.
There's a pattern here.
So Marcus, I did want to ask, you know, you brought up your dabbling at least with in-basket messaging AI capabilities, but I'm curious, what kind of ventures are you cautiously venturing out into with AI?
Well, so a number of pieces with AI, but in terms of the generative AI, we have partnered with Epic to start to look at potential prompts back for patient medical advice requests.
Sure.
So when a patient sends a message in, being able to at least initially provide person right now in at our health system, that would be the provider, provides the provider with a potential prompt. It says, here's something you can reply back to the patient with. And then the provider can choose, do I use it? Do I not use it? Do I use a piece of it? And again, that's kind of the start. But so looking at prompt engineering, one of our other physician informaticists, Dr. Richard Truxillo, has been doing a lot of work on that prompt engineering to kind of get it so that it's not too flowery, because you might not want to send a response that's too flowery back to the patient, because then they may want to respond back and you may end up in these back and forth exchanges. Also working to keep things short. You don't want a really lengthy response. So that's the place that we're using the generative AI. Certainly we're using machine learning for early sepsis. We also have a risk or a deterioration index that we use that is built on some of that neural network functionality, not generative AI, but machine learning.
Can I ask you, so for the folks who are involved with using generative to draft those initial responses back to patients, did you start by targeting like a certain set of, I guess, specialties where you found like the inbox message count was the highest and that's where the biggest bang would be? Or was it more that you just found folks who put their hands up? It didn't matter what specialties they were. Yeah. They eager early adopters to try this. Like, how did you think about where you gave access to initially?
Yeah, tech savvy. So people that have some experience with technology or that are more technology friendly. We were looking initially kind of across the spectrum, do it in this specialty and this specialty and primary care. But as we were doing the initial testing, we found that the responses were not as good in the specialty areas. So we shifted and we said, we're going to pick a couple primary care sites. And so we have two family medicine and one internal medicine site right now that are in our pilot. The other thing that we did in terms of the individuals that are in the pilot we wanted to make sure that they had a little bit of time to respond to feedback requests. So we didn't want to go after somebody who is just completely overwhelmed, because we want those providers to be able to look at what was generated, send a response back to the patient, but then provide feedback on what was generated. Was it good? Was it bad? Did they use a piece of it? Did they use the whole thing? Did they just not use it at all? Why? And so needed some time there for them to provide that feedback. And we're about a month in now. We have not looked at our data yet. We're generating that, and we should be looking at that in the next couple of weeks. And then we'll determine, do we want to expand? Do we need to re-engineer the prompts a little bit? You know, kind of where do we head?
It's so funny to ask you. So like, based on that feedback, it's not that the model itself is being adjusted. It's more that in the background, you're going to adjust the prompts. Okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. That's brilliant. Well, yeah.
And so things like respond to the patient as if I were a physician or as if I were a cardiologist, with limiting response to 500 characters and really putting that together. So when it drops into the AI, that you get something back that you could really be proud of. And that's taken a lot of time. The prompt engineering has taken considerable amount of time.
That's it. So on the clinician end, they're not having to modify or do any of the prompting. It's more the idea is that it doesn't dramatically change their current workflow.
Correct. What the patient types in, feeds in, kind of wrapped with the prompt, and then something is given to the provider. And to the provider, it's seamless. They don't even see that happening. When they open up the message, there's a block of text that says, here's a potential response.
Right. I love it. It's so lovely, because I think there's probably certain very savvy people who would say, hey, like, can I just like, I want to control the whole prompt. But like 99% of your providers don't have that sort of desire to have control. And so like, what's the easiest way to like lower the friction for folks to even use it, is to like make it as simple as possible. Yep. Like actually don't allow that much customizability of the prompt, like if you're trying to get adoption. And I'm curious how you think about success of this. So I think one of the things we've heard from a lot of other CMIOs is the expectation is not that you're going to get 100% adoption from clinicians, but what would good look like? Would it be like, hey, if even like a quarter of clinicians end up using this long-term, that's good? Or what's good enough that's worthwhile to keep, I guess, continue to do this long-term?
That's a great question. I think at this point in time, we are a little bit unsure of what metrics we should be using when this goes large scale. Because we know that there are costs associated with each message, with each token. And so is it a decrease in time by providers? Maybe. Is it fewer patient messages coming back in terms of re-question? So, you know, am I able to close the gap with one message? Because, you know, not only did I answer this question, but there was the kind of this other thing in the message that maybe I would have missed the first time, but the AI is able to get that and do the whole thing. I think another piece that we are looking at is if we turn this on for others other than providers. So if we're using the notion of teamwork and using what we call pools, so a message comes in, it doesn't come straight to the provider because maybe a nurse can answer the question. And so that message goes into the pool first, and we give the nurse the opportunity to use the generative AI. And now the nurse can close that message and, you know, and get the patient what they need. It never gets to the provider, which from a provider standpoint, is great, right? Because then I don't have to do any of that. And so being able to look at how we can shift the messages, but still address the patient need. So we're still trying to figure out what absolute metrics we should be using for success. I think if you take it up to 30,000 feet, provider happiness, right? So being able to do a survey and saying, okay, we have this put in now, it's been running for 6 months. Are you happier with patient medical advice requests? And if they say yes, then great. And also patients, how do you feel about the patient medical advice answers that you've been getting from us? Doing surveys like that is long and hard. And so we probably won't go down that road as to the patients, but maybe for the providers.
That's awesome. That was really very, very thoughtful. And you're right, it goes well beyond just adoption. It's the impact on operations, patient satisfaction, staff satisfaction. That all makes sense.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the joy of medicine. And so part of that joy is I don't have to do it. I don't have the questions anymore.
Love it. So actually, Marcus, this goes in line with possibly exploring this generative capability further down the road, but also with other technologies that you currently have at the organization. I've heard you talk in the past about getting both the technology platforms and the people that you have to really operate at the top of their license. What's been an effective strategy for you to, let's look at the technology part, but really understand the full capabilities of technology you already have in the system? How do you impart this knowledge and learnings across the organization?
Well, it's still a work in process. We're not perfect, but engage with your vendors. So bring the vendors back in, asking, what are we not utilizing that we should? And then figuring out a strategy to kind of enlighten the rest of the organization. Some of that is almost like you're bringing that vendor back in to sell something again. But we've seen that bright shiny that's maybe somebody says, oh my gosh, I talked to a person who said that there's this piece of software and we really need to go implement that thing because it's the new IT thing. If we already have that in our parking garage, but we're not using it, then being able to bring in that vendor and showcase it. Part of the trick there is the notion of good enough. So that specific piece of software, may have lots of bells and whistles on it. It may solve problems you didn't even know you had, right? or don't have. And so using what you do have, can you get to good enough? And if it's free and good enough, I mean, that's great. That saves a bunch of money. So having those conversations. The other thing that has been helpful with some of our vendors is actually bringing staff on site. So bringing their programmers here to Carilion, have them work with our providers, staff, how are we using the software? And then they can engage, say, oh, you're not doing that thing? Have you thought about this bright, shiny piece that we could implement? And, oftentimes I can tell a provider, we should do this thing or we should do that thing. But, who am I? I'm just the associate CMIO. I've been here a long time. What do I know? But, when the 25-year-old from Epic comes down and says, we really should do this thing, they listen to them because they're from outside. And hey, sometimes you get a little bit of traction that way.
I'm curious because it feels like it's the opposite where if you're sort of on the inside, like people trust you, they know you're not some, third-party vendor, they don't have an ulterior motive. But you're saying sometimes actually someone who's not from the inside, I'm not saying they're more trustworthy to your colleagues, but maybe they may not be seen as having a different, a certain agenda. Maybe it's if they're already an existing vendor, there's no real agenda because it's not like they can sell you more and make more money. It's more like, no, it's already implemented. You can use it or not. We hope you use it, but we don't care if you do or not. Is that why sometimes that third party can be, helpful? Or
I think so. And I think sometimes it's just the mindset. When you have somebody from the outside that has come in and is engaging with a group, that engagement is different than what they're used to. And sometimes the mind opens up and they're open to new ideas at that point, rather than kind of, as you pointed out, kind of the same discussions that we've been having for a long time where, everybody has their roles and they're doing what they're doing. And so sometimes if you mix that up a little bit, people are open to new ideas.
Yeah. Your comment about is the bright, shiny thing good enough, I think really resonated. I think the analogy that came to my mind was imagine you had someone came in saying, hey, I want to bring a Tesla to Carilion. And you're like, hey, I don't know if you know this, but we actually have cars already at Carilion. Now, it may not be a Tesla, but it could be driven from point A to point B. And it's like, okay, well, if all you care about is being able to drive something, then maybe our cars are good enough. But if you're saying for some reason you have to have Tesla autopilot, it has to have autonomous capabilities. Okay, well, why is that? Maybe there's a good enough reason, and then maybe you do get a Tesla. But if it's like, actually, no, you're right, Marcus. We just need to be able to drive something ourselves from point A to point B. I guess our cars are good enough. I just didn't know we had cars in the health system. Kind of makes sense.
And the extension of that is maybe we don't have an electric car today, but if you wait 6 months, you know, we'll have one. And so then you don't have to go out and get that thing. I've seen that a lot with Epic systems where sometimes they're not the fastest to production, but if you give them some time, they come around and then they usually do it at least as good or maybe even better at some other areas. Yeah.
So, Marcus, I wanted to ask you, you know, as a devoted West Virginia Mountaineers football fan, you have a very unique perspective on the dynamics of team sports. I'm curious, how do you see the principles of teamwork, strategy, and adaptability from the football field translating into the collaborative world of healthcare informatics?
Oh, yeah. So I don't know how other colleges do it. I imagine it's kind of the same, but I remember touring the Milan Pushkar Center, which is where the WV football team trains, when they had this really interesting setup. And so they have a room, the quarterback room, and they have the wide receiver room, and they have the offensive line room, they have the defensive line room, and the, you know, safety room, the special team room, and that's where the teams do their work. But then they can pull back a section, and so now you have a room where you have the quarterbacks and the wide receivers, and so you can bring those two teams together to collaborate when they need to, and then you can pull back another area, and now you have the whole offense. They can work together as a team. And so I really like that notion of, you know, here we have the MyChart group, or we have the pharmacy group, or we have the whatever aspect it is that's working, and they're doing their thing. But they have to see how that's connected to the bigger picture. And so you have the IT workers doing their thing. You have our clinical informatics groups that are doing their workflow and their translation. And you have our training group that's doing things. And sometimes they need to be working independently, but they can't work in silos. And so you've got to bring that whole team together at some point in order to be successful. So that's the analogy.
I love that. So the last question that I had, this is just to give a bit of context, I just found this out during the research, but I believe the Mountaineers are one of the most winning college football teams or programs in the country, but they've never actually won a national championship. And so my question is, how do you maintain enthusiasm for both your Mountaineers, but then also for informatics?
Yeah. So I can go down a negative route and talk about the year that we almost made it with a coach, but we're not going to do that. Don Nealon, kind of the coach at WV for many, many years, and he was just inducted to the Hall of Fame this year. He had a really unique perspective. His perspective was, on any given New Year's Day, there are a bunch of bowl games, and for a lot of people, that's going to be their last game. So if all you're worried about is making it to number one, you're going to leave a lot of people behind. And his thought was, these are college kids that are here to get a degree, maybe get that paid for while they're here. Maybe a few are going to go on to the NFL, but it really is about growing the team and creating people that are going to go on with their lives and do great things outside of football. And so I really like that, in that, okay, we maybe have never played in the national championship, and maybe we never will, but we have a lot of kids that have come through WVU, through the football program, have gotten educations, and they've gone on and been productive in society. And so I think that's what I focus on.
Yeah.
Different than, you know, maybe Alabama or something like that.
I love that. Well, Marcus, that's great. Just being mindful of your time, we're going to flip over to the Fast Five lightning round. So just kind of five rapid fire questions for you.
I'm excited.
First question that we have is, what is your favorite book or book you've gifted the most?
Yeah, that's probably Tales from Margaritaville. Jimmy Buffett.
Mm-hmm. Love it. Question two, who is a person, either dead or alive, you'd love to meet?
See, question one. Jim Buffett, yeah, he passed away September 4th of this year. And I didn't have the opportunity to meet him, but yeah, I think that'd be really fun.
Yeah. Awesome. Question three, would you rather have super strength, super speed, or the ability to read people's minds?
Super speed.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, question four, what is something in healthcare you believe that others might find insane?
Scrubs is real.
The TV show, or?
Yes. I watched the opening, you know, the first time I watched that, my wife and I, and we just laughed. And she laughed because she thought it was funny, and I laughed because I knew that that's really what goes on.
That's
I love it.
Question five, last question. If you could travel back in time to any event or moment, what would it be and why?
That would be Dallas. I would go back to the JFK shooting. I would wow. love to have been a fly on the wall behind Oswald to see, was he really the guy?
Mm. Yeah, that'd be fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing, Marcus. Again, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing some time with us. There's a ton of wisdom that you've sprinkled throughout the conversation. And I know I'm super glad that you were on. I'm sure our listeners are as well. That's a wrap for this episode of The Digital Patient, hosted by SeamlessMD. You can follow us on Twitter at SeamlessMD. And if you like the podcast and you want to learn more, visit www.seamless.md. Marcus, Dr. Speaker, again, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you all.